It's Saturday, April 25th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and a discussion with the geeks about the week's technology, and we take your calls.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak. Hi, welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. It's a love-hate relationship. Love your cars, hate it when they break. You'll love the car guys, and hate to miss them when Click and Clack give their advice on things automotive. Every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday morning at 9, right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS, in Santa Cruz. Specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. In the air room, I'm joined by Geek's Ben Jaffe. Hello, Ben. Oh, of course. Actually, potting you up would be a good idea.
Good morning. That's not me.
There we go.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Ryder Brooks.
Good morning.
Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy, and Ryder Brooks, a support engineer at Sun Microsystems, although now that's Oracle.
Well, not yet, but probably.
Maybe and, in good time. Bureaucracy takes a long time.
And I'm Miles Elam, a slacker and student.
I'm glad one of us is a slacker.
So, Ben, would you like to start off on news?
Yeah. I just want to do a quick follow-up. So, Dr. Dawn was on the last hour. She was talking about Bluetooth versus cell phones. And
right.
I just wanted to throw a couple figures out there, which is Bluetooth devices are defined in three power classes. You have Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 devices. Bluetooth headsets, I believe most of them are Class 2 devices. There are some that are Class 1. Class 1 is 1 milliwatt is the power level, which is very, very small. And then Class 2 is 10 milliwatts.
Wait, 1 milliwatt?
1 milliwatt.
How many milliwatts in a watt? It's a
thousand. I always get that confused because million, yeah, whatever.
So when we
1,000, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So when we talk about a light bulb, a standard incandescent, we're talking 60 watts.
Yes.
So this is talking about 60,000. I mean, if you took 60,000 Bluetooth Class 1 devices, they would equal one light bulb.
They would pull the same amount. Yeah. That's some good perspective. Although it's not necessarily that simple because, you know, light bulbs, they emit radiation, but it's in the visible light spectrum, whereas Bluetooth...
And heat.
And heat, yeah. Whereas Bluetooth, or largely, I should say, whereas Bluetooth emits in different spectrums, right? And so when talking about potential health issues and everything, you have to take that into account. Same between Bluetooth and cell phones. So Bluetooth headsets usually emit around 10 milliwatts or less. I believe that's the maximum power rating for that class of devices. Whereas cell phones, just a figure I just found, is that cell phones are designed to operate at a maximum power level of 0.6 watts, which is 60 times the maximum power level of a Class 2 Bluetooth device. So, it's not as simple as an issue as I'm making it out to be, but because they're in different frequencies. But it's almost definitely better to use a Bluetooth headset than to use your mobile phone while held up to your
right.
your brain.
But even when you're talking about different frequencies, because we are also talking about frequencies, it seems strange to think of it this way, but frequencies of light.
Mm-hmm.
That you're just raising the frequency and it's beyond our visible spectrum.
Yeah, far beyond.
Right. I remember seeing a stat on this or an analogy of this where let's say you were wearing a burqa where you're able to see just through that little slit of cloth
mm-hmm.
and that is the human visible spectrum. If that were the case, the cloth going above and below the slit would be measured in miles.
Yeah.
In terms of that's how blind we are.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely see in a very, very narrow spectrum.
So we're talking about light going further up from the slit, as it were.
And different animals see in different spectrums. Insects are actually really interesting because a lot of times they can see a much wider range than we can. And they can also see, many of them can see ultraviolet.
Yeah, a wider range? I thought it was just shifted up. That they could see more ultraviolet, but they couldn't see in the infrared.
I'm actually not positive about being a wider range. I got the impression that it was, but it's definitely shifted up at least. Mm-hmm. That they can see higher frequencies of light or of EM radiation, if you will.
Right. But the bottom line here, though, is we're talking about ionizing versus non-ionizing radiation. Mm-hmm. The difference there, just in a nutshell, is ionizing radiation can knock things around. Mm-hmm. This is the type of thing that would give you skin cancer, for example, if you're mm-hmm. out in the sun. It's an ionizing radiation. It's actually able to cause damage and generate a mutation, mm-hmm. whereas non-ionizing can't. It doesn't have enough of an energy level. And so... I am curious as to how much damage you can cause from the energy level from a cell phone and Bluetooth. But I'm looking forward to seeing any definitive. So far, I haven't seen anything that would suggest
that. Definitely doing a lot of studies on it. I'm certainly not by any means an expert on in this field at all. But I have read that some studies have shown that there's a localized heating effect in the tissue surrounding where you're holding the phone up to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because this is EM radiation, if you double the distance away from the transmitter, you're quartering the amount of radiation you get. So it's the same law with light.
Right. It's inverse square law.
Yeah, the inverse square law. So if you're holding it right up to your head versus a little bit away from your head, chances are that's actually a large difference in how much radiation. But, I mean, it's not... I don't know. I guess my bottom line is that Bluetooth is probably a better technology to be holding next to your ear. And also, if you're talking about driving and talking on the phone at the same time,
it's all
a moot point because you don't have a choice unless you want to get tacked a fine on.
Yeah. Also, just to keep in mind, this reminded me of the story with Dr. Don. They were talking about mm-hmm. heat, the heat issue. Is even if I have my phone not transmitting at all, if I have an airplane mode, is what it's called, so that you can play around with games but not actually interfere with any electronics that are on the mm-hmm. on the airplane, my phone will get hot. And that's simply a function of the same reason why your computer is hot, why it needs a CPU fan on it.
Because the energy is moving around inside.
Right. You have electricity being discharged from a battery. It's going to generate heat.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So, yeah, definitely as far as, the cell phone getting hot, that's not necessarily evidence of anything at all. How much radiation it's outputting or something.
But we're not doctors and curious to see how things pan out in the next 10 years.
Yeah, same disclaimer.
So let's move on. Ryder.
Okay, we'll change topic a little bit. So Windows 7, that's been having a series of beta releases, is now Microsoft has announced that they're going to do a release candidate May 5th to the general public. There have already been some... leaked versions out on the internet, BitTorrents and whatnot. An interesting couple of features that have been introduced as of the release candidate are a Windows XP compatibility mode. And what they've done is they've taken a virtual PC technology that they bought back in 2003 and have incorporated it into Windows 7. What they're going to allow you to do is download a full copy of Windows XP with Service Pack 3 and run it as a virtual machine within Windows 7, which will provide, and it's only going to be for their Enterprise and Ultimate editions that they're going to have out, but you'll essentially be able to have 100% compatibility with all your applications with Windows 7 by virtue of running XP virtually on the same box. And it has tight integration, so you'll have one application, you just run it, and it runs as XP with an XP window right next to another application that looks like Windows 7 Windows.
Very cool. Actually happy to hear that it's doing a virtualization technology. Yes. Remembering back in the day when Windows 95 was out and they were doing backwards compatibility with Windows 3.1 mm-hmm. and DOS 16 and 8-bit technologies respectively. Yeah. And there were basically all of the cruft that was with the previous operating system had to be carried forward in order to make it work. So with the virtualization technology, you're making a firewall there between them. This is the old, this is the new, and never the twain shall mix.
Yeah, and prior to that, you'd have to mess around with the properties and select a different, you know, Windows 95 mode, XP mode, Vista mode, which who knows what magic it was doing behind the scenes on that to make it work. this is much nicer. It's probably not going to work very well for games just because virtualization does have a CPU hit on it. You know, I've seen... Well, one of the requirements actually is that it has to have a virtualized CPU that, you know, like the VT extensions that you use for virtualization, so you can...
So the extensions on the CPU.
Exactly. Okay. So, and that helps a bit with performance to make it more native, but you probably will see a slight degradation in performance virtualizing your applications in another OS.
Yeah, but of course you're getting a new machine, so you won't really notice a difference. It'll all be going faster anyway.
Probably not.
Thank you, Moore's Law.
So that's great. And another feature that they have is ability to remotely stream your music. You're kind of tied into the media player. You have to have a media player version of the same on a client, but you can stream it from your computer at home across the internet to another computer. And they're providing all the software to do that within the OS now, which is kind of a nice little feature.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Ben, you have another news story?
I do, but I just want to follow up to the Windows 7 story. Mm-hmm. Apparently... the release candidate for Windows 7 will be available on April 30th, which is 5 days from now,
mm-hmm.
which is crazy.
Well, I think it's being released to the OEMs and partners at that date.
It's,
it's already leaked.
Well, yeah, of course. So apparently it's being released sometime soon. So maybe with all of this hype and all of this news, all the news that we've and discussion, everything that we've been covering over all this time, we'll get to see how it looks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of it being leaked, how do you give me some commentary? What do you think it's going to have an effect upon its adoption?
I think that maybe in this early stage, if you leak something like that, maybe that could actually only have a positive effect because you get people using it and you get people talking about it. That's assuming you have a good product. If you have a bad product, then you'll get a bunch of bad reviews. But you'll get the reviews faster. Because you have more people using it mm-hmm. than maybe would normally have access to it.
Yeah, you know, I've heard rumors that, you know, people at Microsoft are using this as their production desktops, and you know, just rumors.
Well, I hope so.
but you know, I think this is a much more fully baked product than Vista was going out the door, and you know, it's faster and whatnot. And the fact that they've been promoting this, you know, having open betas and giving it to everybody and relaxing the licensing and the expiration times on it is, you know, they want everyone to have it, you know, and that's, I think they're doing a great job in terms of publicity. I mean, I haven't heard of many people saying, you know, Windows 7 sucks. So I don't think leaking it is really hurting, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Ben, there's something about an exoplanet?
Yes.
First off, what's an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is a planet that is outside of our solar system, which is where the exo comes from. It means it's outside of our solar system. So we've been discovering exoplanets all over the place. They're just all of a sudden they're everywhere. As we're looking for more and more, we're finding them faster and faster. So we have just discovered the lightest exoplanet that we've found so far.
Lightest.
The lightest meaning...
How is something light when it's in space?
Less mass.
Okay. Less massive.
Yeah, okay. Actually, that's kind of a silly thing. It's actually in the news story on the European Organization for Astronomical Research and...
Astronomical?
Astronomical, yes. Oh, my God. It's a little early. Okay. Anyway, that's on their website. So, it's their fault. I blame them. Anyway, the least massive exoplanet so far. Of course, these planets are very, 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 very far away. You know, so we're relying on detection mechanisms like looking at the light output of stars and seeing if the light dims at any point. Then we can infer that a planet has passed in front of the star. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Or checking the star's wobble, or having another star that's closer to us and using the gravitational field to be able to use what's called a gravitational lensing.
Yeah.
This is something that I really miss John Tracy. He was always so good at this.
It's such cool stuff. But yeah, I mean, you're effectively shining a telescope at this gigantic source of light and trying to detect something that's not outputting light, you know, that's just bouncing a little bit of light on.
Once again, we're seeing that little small section of cloth, and we've got kilometers
except
on either.
In this case, we've got light years on either side. No. But in any case, they discovered the lightest exoplanet that we've found so far, which is actually 1.9 times the mass of the Earth, which is a pretty cool discovery.
A little less than twice the size of the Earth.
Just under twice the size, yeah. And it's 20.5 light years away in the constellation Libra, because apparently we still measure things in constellations for some reason. And we also have refined the orbit of another exoplanet in that same system, which is called Gliese. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but Gliese 581d, which is a much more massive planet. With an orbit of its host star of about 67 days. But anyway, the quote from the researchers said that that planet could be covered by a large and deep ocean. It could be, you know, we're not saying it is, mm-hmm. but it could be covered by a large and deep ocean, and it's the first serious water world candidate. So this is kind of exciting news that, you know, we two discoveries in this one system or around this one star.
Wonderful.
So, pretty cool stuff.
Thank you, Ben. Ryder.
So, Ubuntu is a Linux distributor that releases a new version every 6 months, and they've just come out with version 9.04. And I've had a chance to play with it a little bit. It's pretty slick. They've increased their boot times, which has been, decreased their boot times, yes. So, I've seen demos of people running solid-state drives and it booting after it gets past the BIOS in like 5 seconds.
Oh, my God. That's nuts.
Yeah. And in most cases, it would start like about 25 seconds, which is still not too bad.
I mean, my computer, when I wake it from sleep, it takes about 5 seconds to be completely awake, mm-hmm. like completely up and running and usable and everything's refreshing and everything.
And you have a solid-state drive on yours? Or
I don't.
You don't?
Okay. I have a MacBook Pro. That's just waking up from sleep. That's not booting from
That's just straight from
nothing,
RAM, yeah.
You know? That's amazing.
So they've actively been working on decreasing their boot times. They've also enhanced their CPU support. So they, in addition to x86, at one point they supported PowerPC processors, and they dropped that back in, I think, the 6 series. But they're now supporting the ARM CPUs, which I think some of these netbooks or smartphones. What else runs ARM processors? Is it mostly just netbooks?
Yeah, it's in my iPhone.
Yeah, it's in your iPhone. Yeah. So it, you know, basically just extends, you know, the ability of where you can put Ubuntu in different distributions. Okay. They have a netbook version that comes out that's kind of, you know.
Anytime you need some level of CPU power, but you need it at very low power output or power draw, mm-hmm. that's where you'd use an ARM processor. That's where it dominates. In fact, there are far more ARM processors out there than I believe Intel Pentium CPUs.
Wow.
Nice.
I didn't know that.
Just because they fill in the little cracks, all the little spaces, as opposed to the desktop systems.
It's a good market to be in.
It's across the board enhancements if you are an Ubuntu user. If you've never used Linux, Ubuntu, I think, is a great distribution. I know Miles has spoken favorably of it in the past.
Yes, even though my laptop with it is now dying, it's not the fault of Ubuntu. It's the fault of a laptop that was purchased created in 1998. So it's mm-hmm. you know, it's past
Ubuntu,
its prime.
Ubuntu is working wonders with a piece of old hardware
yeah.
that you got.
Yeah,
you
know, actually, Ubuntu, but
I have
yeah.
about a 5-year-old HP business notebook that. Prior to the last couple of releases, didn't have any 3D driver support, and since of like 8.10, they started integrating a lot more of the 3D hardware accelerated 3D drivers into their core X server, and it's made a world of difference. I mean, this should become an eye candy machine. So you know, I installed it on my wife's laptop, and I'm like, oh, can I have this back?
Yeah. And Ben was gracious enough to let me use his laptop while mine is out of commission. And it's a little tiny Dell.
Yeah, I just got it, Dell netbook.
And
I'm
going to
play around with it.
this one's running an Atom processor as opposed to an ARM, but it's running Ubuntu and it's running it quite
well. Oh, it's running Dell's version of Ubuntu, which has the little whatchamathingy and doohickey and here and there. And
that's the
dock.
That's, of course, the technical jargon for everything right there.
Well, all the stuff that they install for you that, you know, I don't know. I like my Ubuntu fresh.
Yes, it's the farmer's market for Ubuntu. So at any rate, Ben, you had a story about bionic penguins.
Yeah. Who doesn't love penguins? And who doesn't love bionic? That's not a word. There are these
bionics.
God, I'm awful at talking today.
Yeah, good said.
Thanks much. I'm lucky to have you here. Okay. Bionic penguins. They have this company called Festo, who produces these kinds of crazy robotic things. I'm feeling so unable to speak right now. Anyway, so they've created these robotic penguins, and they can swim in water, and they can swim in air as well if you fill them up with helium. They're really cool.
You're filling them up with helium? I'm sorry.
Not real penguins. No.
Okay.
Bionic
just,
penguins.
Just making sure.
Okay. So they've made two versions of these bionic penguins, right?
But they're not real. They're not actual penguins.
Oh,
bionics.
They're not enhanced.
Yeah. Okay. Let's say mechanical.
Okay.
Robotics. I'll blame the news story again, because that was the headline, right? I didn't think...
You're really having problems this morning, aren't you?
What does bionic mean? Yeah. Okay, bionic, bio. Okay, so anyway, these mechanical... Bionic sounds cooler, but mechanical penguins, right? And they've built two versions of these, and one of the versions swims, and one of the versions floats and swims through, quote-unquote, swims through air. And they've got these mechanical flippers and everything, and they can make these very subtle movements just like real penguins would and swim actually with a surprising amount of dexterity. They also carry a 3D sonar that was developed by this other country called Evologix. This is all in Germany. And with this 3D sonar, they can actually navigate the world, you know? So they don't have... an idea of where they are. They're actually using sonar, much like bats would or much like dolphins would, to swim around these different...
They're in the water,
though, right? Oh, I'm having so much trouble this morning. Anyway, okay, I can't do it justice. Go to geekspeak.org. I'll submit the news story and check out the video. That will explain everything that I've been stumbling with.
Yes, the video is worth 1,000 pictures.
and that's apparently worth 1,000,000 Ben explanations. So.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. Thank you very much for listening. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisan coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potrero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com.
Hey, you said Potrero, right?
Yes, I said Potrero. And GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Whole Foods Market, featuring products of over 100 Santa Cruz area producers, free of pesticides, preservatives, antibiotics, and hormones. Whole Foods Market, Santa Cruz, is now open on SoCal Avenue between Branch 40 and Seabright. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Once again in the air room, I have Ben Jaffe and Ryder Brooks. And we're talking about technology. If you want to call in and join the conversation, the numbers are 476-2800. That's 476-2800. Or you can call toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or go to geekspeak.org right now and send us a message. Also, we have a public chat. So if you go to...
if you go to the GeekSpeak show page, it's on the left. It says...
Thank you.
Yeah.
And that will
join
give
us
a,
in the chat, yeah.
Give a link to Etherpad.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go.
All right.
I'm having I'm having a great day, too, just along with you, Ben.
Blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah. So, next story.
Okay. So, Gamefly is a popular rental source for PC, Mac gamers. It's sort of like the gaming equivalent of Netflix or online Blockbuster. Actually, Blockbuster, they still do online rentals? I guess they do, don't they? Anyway, Gamefly has filed a complaint with the United States Postal Service for claiming that they have been doing improper sorting, causing some of their games, CDs, DVDs to be breaking in transit. And they've also alleged that their competitors are actually getting better treatment by the Postal Service than they are.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember this with Netflix. I've been a Netflix subscriber for a long time, and every now and again, you'd get this shattered CD in the mail or DVD. And
yikes!
And over the years, they've evolved their mailers and changed things around to try and make it better. But they've been dealing with theft, and Gamefly apparently is just kind of having to go take their turn at this. They've claimed that they've had about a 1-2% rate of destroying of their merchandise. So, and games, I think they're a little bit more expensive than your movie counterpart. It costs like $20-25 to rebuy a movie versus games can be, you know, $45-50. So, I think their damages that they're incurring are taking a chunk out of their revenue. But apparently the Postal Service has, over the years, has given sort of a preferential treatment to Netflix and Blockbuster and whatnot because of their distinctive packaging, and they can just yank it out of the process and manually sort them, or maybe they've developed special equipment, I'm not sure, to accommodate that kind of packaging. But
I believe that we had a news story a while back that was talking about that there actually is a section up for Netflix because it's such a volume.
Right. So Gamefly is basically complaining that saying, hey, we're paying a flat rate for our packaging. We're willing to pay more to get, you know, better handling of our merchandise, not seeing any results. So they're basically claiming that they're kind of being dissed while Netflix and the other competitors are getting preferential handling for paying less of, you know, a bulk rate while they're not getting the same treatment. So it's kind of interesting what goes behind the scenes. And then on top of that, there's the whole theft thing. You know, you have, you know, I know it's gone on with Netflix and Blockbuster movies where it was clearly identified this is a movie coming down, and you could see, you know, theft occur anywhere along the pipeline from the source to its customer or returning back. And that seems even more enticing for games with distinctive Gamefly packaging.
Okay.
So... Fun.
It's funny when you bring up Netflix and different materials going over the Postal Service back and forth. There's actually a site that I came across recently called Book-A-Book. It's caused some consternation in copyright circles because it's similar to what you might expect from an online library. One person reads a book, and when they're done with it, they ship it through or Book-A-Book allows you to know who wants to read that book next. So you mail that book to the next person, who mails it to the next person, mails it to the next person. So there's only one copy of the book. And so there are some folks angry about this, saying, like, no, this is wrong. You're taking money away. And at the same time, it's the same model that a library has been on, something that's a concept that's centuries old.
Or just, you know, loaning a book to somebody personally, or, you know, paying it forward, you know.
Right, except for the fact that you don't know the other
right,
person.
Right.
So this is on a wider scale.
Interesting.
So that's something to it's curious how technology, communication lines are able to have us deal with issues that weren't even on the map before. It's kind of like, you know, the framers of the Constitution having to write about stuff, but they didn't have any concept of telephones or instant communication was unknown. How do you make laws that are based upon that?
Yeah. How does Book-A-Book work? Is that a pay service or is it just a grassroots kind of thing built up and allows people to just kind of share what they have?
Unfortunately, I don't know that much about it. If you want to take a look at it, it's www.book-a-book.com. This is not an endorsement. It's just it looked like an interesting concept. Looks like something to keep an eye on. And Ben, Oh, actually, it looks like we have a call coming in. No, well, I'll wait for that.
Yeah, we'll do that in a moment. The FBI has used spyware to catch a criminal. So in... Wait a sec, I've got my dates wrong. So back in 2005, this Massachusetts man cut 18 cables that were carrying voice and data that were owned by... oh, funny, I don't know that. Okay, anyway, cut these, and there's this investigation going on and everything, and turns out the FBI actually used this computer program called the Computer and Internet Protocol Address Verifier, which is really just a fancy name for a piece of malware, a Trojan, that would install itself or be installed on a suspect's computer after, of course, you know, they get permission from a court and everything, and send back the IP address and MAC address and everything and local information like that. So that's actually how they caught this guy. They suspected him and everything, and they used the spyware to get the information they needed to actually convict him.
That's curious, using malware like that. A Trojan, of course, being you're pretending to be something else to get someone to install you, and then it does something different.
Yeah. We first learned about this program in 2007, in mid-2007. There's these court records related to a case that had to do with some bomb threats that were sent, that were emailed to a high school in Washington. And the FBI planted the CIPAV on this 15-year-old's computer. And actually, they planted it on his computer through a link posted on his MySpace page. That's how they infected him, by getting him by posting a link to this and using an exploit to install it on his computer. So kind of crazy, interesting, slightly scary stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
But definitely a more interesting or a novel use of spyware, you know, to enforce the law as opposed to spyware breaking the law.
Well, thank you for that story.
Big Brother is watching us. Well, that's
So I'm going to put forth a quick news story here. This is about the dangers of user reviews. This is a cautionary tale for Verizon, actually. Normally, we're used to reviews like on a discussion forum talking about Apple products, or let's say on Amazon. That's a very common one. You buy a book and you say, here's how I liked the book. I liked the book. I didn't like the book. Here's the good parts. Here's the bad parts. You know, was this review useful or not? So someone at Verizon thought that it would be a good idea to open up their phone catalog for user reviews. Unfortunately, a lot of the reviews were very negative. And it isn't so much the negative that's the problem. It's how often do you buy a cell phone? Once every 2 years, maybe more.
You're only going to review it if you have negative experience.
Well, and chances are you have your phone and you're using it, and you're not going to go back and think to actually go back to Verizon to put in that, oh, I love this phone, it's great. You know, most of the time, it's just going to be, you know, I like the phone, and you go off and use it and talk it and use it. Only the people that really hate it are going to come back and take the time to say, this is a horrible phone, you should never get it. So it's kind of bitten Verizon where they weren't expecting it. And it does raise some questions about what... when you're using the net, there aren't just these solutions you can make of, well, I'm just going to add in these features that are like Facebook, or I'm just going to use these features that are like eBay, which is a common theme we hear when some marketing executive says, hey, we want to have these features in there, have in there. The features themselves may not be conducive to your business. It's actually trying to tailor it to that. So that that comes to the end there. I actually don't see any listing of lines.
Oh, there they are. They're right below our listing of...
Oh, so the section down there where it says phones is not where it's being done.
Oh, it is. Oh, you
don't
see it?
There we go. Ah, I was looking in the wrong place. So...
Oh, there are two phones.
So I'm going to take a call from Gary in Scotts Valley. Hello, Gary.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a problem. I don't have any icons, no taskbar, or no start on my Windows XP machine. A couple of weeks ago, I got a little pop-up that said MS 2009 anti-spyware, and it was a bug, which I got rid of. But ever since then, I can't get the icons back. I can't get into Windows Explorer, and I've been accessing the computer through the Task Manager.
It sounds like your Explorer.exe process is not running correctly, because that is the process that actually controls the taskbar, the
desktop
shell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I even tried the command prompt, and it says access is denied.
Wait, you tried which prompt?
I used the command prompt. I went in and put explorer.exe, and I got access is denied.
Okay. Mm. You've got some problems. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. You may actually have some malware on your machine.
Either that or you might have some file corruption or something that has prevented the process to...
I ran a bunch of different anti-spyware programs and malware bytes. Mm-hmm. And apparently got rid of it all, and I'm wondering, could this be the result? Like,
are you sure that the malware removers that you ran were reputable ones?
I'm pretty sure they were. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering if this is. It's always far fetched to say that someone has a particular problem. It's mm-hmm. really hard to see say without having the computer in front of you. But it makes me wonder about the behavior of a rootkit. Because Explorer.exe has to go and talk to the kernel in order to get a lot of the information that you see, like the folders that are in your particular directory or the like. And the fact that it's saying access denied and not be able to get back in, I wonder if there's something on the low level of the system that's having a problem. As far as fixing this, some antivirus software might... if that doesn't work, you may have to actually take it into a shop and have them take a look at it.
I think that, number one, if you don't already have a backup, make a backup. If you do have a backup, make a separate backup. Don't overwrite your old backup to make a backup of your machine in this state, right? So do you actually have a backup of your computer before this?
No, I was thinking of getting an external hard drive and...
Okay, so what I would say is, number one, and this is to everyone out there who doesn't have a backup, make sure you have a backup, because eventually your hard drive will fail, or your file system will get corrupted, or some rogue virus will get on your machine and erase everything, and then you'll be in a whole lot of deep water, you know?
Yeah, so, there are two types of people in the world, people who are happily using their computer and the sad people.
yeah, definitely. And most of the sad people are because they don't have a backup and they lost everything. So that's number one. And then also, I mean, conceivably, you could try reinstalling Windows as well. You might have some success there. But if you do that, make sure you have a backup.
Right.
Make sure you have a good backup. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would go so far as to say, make a backup of your entire system and then put your most valued documents and files and photographs on a CD so you have a second backup. You know, because if you reformat your hard drive and install Windows over again, during that process you only have one backup, which is your external hard drive. You
basically
know, so.
Create an archive.
Yeah.
Windows, this was Windows XP, is that correct?
Yeah.
With some versions of XP, it depends on whether or not if this was pre-installed through like a laptop or whatnot, or if you actually have a retail copy of XP. But
no, I've got an OEM copy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You may have to talk to your vendor whether or not it does it, but some copies of XP have a recovery mode that allows you to do a reinstallation of XP without actually destroying
a repair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think this one does. Okay. I think it's just it just says for installation on the disk.
Okay. Yeah. Which you probably won't want to do because that'll just wipe
right.
everything out. Another thing that you might want to do if you have it enabled is there's a recovery point which is turned on by default with XP that allows you to kind of go
tried
back.
I that already.
And that didn't work. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. Best of luck to you. Sorry we couldn't be more helpful.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, a lot of times with an issue like that, if you actually do go and take it into a shop, they may just end up telling you exactly the same thing, which is you need to reinstall, or we'll reinstall it for you and charge you or something.
Often with problems of that caliber, that's often the quickest way to fix it.
Yeah, and a lot of times,
cheapest.
A lot of times a shop will probably just put on an antivirus software, check out the drive. If nothing shows up. And they can't fix it just by
then they'll just
files.
Charge you a diagnostics fee and say sorry.
Or
that's
well,
it.
They'll charge you a diagnostic fee and then say, okay, what do you want us to do from now? And probably reinstall
the option would be reinstalling,
reinstalling the operating
system.
It'd
probably be worth actually getting another copy of XP that has the repair option and trying that because
XP
has
is
all
expensive,
that has. Yeah, well, if you can borrow somebody's copy,
yeah,
I mean, it's you have your own license already. It doesn't matter what media you're using.
Yeah.
So we'll take a call now. How about Perry from Santa Cruz?
Hi.
Hi. You have a smartphone you want to hack?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a Nokia Symbian operating system.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 6650, actually.
That's the model of the Nokia. It's a. Do you remember if it's a Series 60 or Series 80? Have you ever heard those terms before?
I don't know that.
You mean the OS?
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think it was the newer one. I think I checked and it was the newer one.
Okay. So what types of info are you looking for?
Well, I'm just wondering if you can point me towards some sort of resource somewhere where I want to change what shows up on the welcome screen, like when you open up the main screen, there's all the icons there, and they go to different things.
You're really talking about hacking into it, not just adding an application for it.
Right, exactly.
I think we'd have to research that. Your best bet are probably going to be dedicated forums to cell phones, things like that, or Symbian OS sites that, it shouldn't be that hard to actually do that with the Symbian.
Yeah.
Don't have a Nokia, haven't hacked
it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I have this feeling like this way be dragons.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, this is not to totally dissuade you. I mean, it's still a neat hack to do. It's neat to be able to change your phone around. I mean, that's the idea behind all the folks with the jailbroken iPhones and stuff like that. But
a lot of times there will be applications that you can, if you can get them onto your phone, then they'll let you do things like change permissions of files and modify files and overwrite files that you normally wouldn't even be able to see, let alone overwrite. So you might want to look for some kind of file browser for that kind of phone or that phone OS. I have a Sony Ericsson Z750A, and I actually found an application that I can install on that, and that lets me see all of the files that I normally can't see, and actually also delete files that are on my phone that are locked that I can't delete, if I want to, reclaim that space. So that might be an option for you.
There might even be a program that, kind of change what shows up on your start menu.
Yeah, I would just do some Google searches, maybe spend a good 15 or 30 minutes just doing some Google searches and searching for, Nokia 6650 and then a file browser or change, do some Googling and you might find some.
You may be looking at, having to actually reflash the firmware on the phone in order to get the extra functionality that you want. That's
right. That's what I was saying. This way be dragons.
Yeah. If you're up for it, it's fun. Usually as long as you can get the original firmware back and you have a recovery point, probably no damage done to your phone. Not always the case. I know people hacking iPhones and brick their phones, but it just really depends. I think with Symbian that it shouldn't be too hard.
Yeah, I'd say go into it expecting complete and utter failure and being okay with that.
Uh-huh.
And then you just might be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, have another phone handy or something.
Yeah.
Is anybody there familiar with Symbian?
Not firsthand.
Not, no.
There's a website, allaboutsymbian.com.
There we go. I think I'll go there.
Thank you for your call, Perry, and let us know how it turns out.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the show.
Yeah, take care.
Bye-bye.
And, oh, also, if you were to post on our forums, you might actually get some responses from fellow listeners. It's becoming more and more of a resource. So
what's the – how do you find the forums?
You go to geekspeak.org and you click on forums, which is one of the tabs in the upper right-hand corner.
Wonderful.
And go ahead and make an account and start posting. We'd love to see you there. And we'll all at least I certainly participate a lot in the forums. So,
okay. And line 3, Elizabeth from Aptos. Are you there? Elizabeth? Looks like we might have lost her.
Maybe.
Okay.
Oh, well, Elizabeth, if you hear us, then please call back and we'll talk about a stat counter for web hits.
Indeed.
So, anybody have any news left?
No. Well, I finally hacked my iPod Touch.
you jailbroke it?
Yeah.
So what did you do with that?
All sorts of stuff. I've been putting on different applications. There's a whole like app store that's not Apple that you can get stuff that's free and something you pay for. And I thought it was an interesting news material, though, is the generation 2 of the Apple iPod Touch actually changed the hardware, and for the longest time it was not possible to jailbreak it. And then you could do a tether jailbreak where you actually had to plug it in, and any time that you actually powered it off fully, it would revert back to its prior state. And they had some technological issues trying to get past that. And a few weeks ago, I realized that a patch was finally available, and the news behind that was kind of interesting in that their iPhone dev team, I think, is what they refer to themselves. Mm-hmm. And they mostly work on the iPhone technology stuff. They were sitting on this hack that would actually work with the Generation 2 iPod Touch, but they weren't releasing it because they wanted to wait until the third generation iPhone came out, which they suspected would be using the same hardware protections in it. And so they were sitting on it, and we were going to wait till that came out in June or whenever it comes out, and then basically cover both at once. But their information got leaked, and somebody was out there selling this patch for like $50 where they could get into it. They decided, okay, so some jerk's trying to make money off this, so we'll release it.
Yeah, isn't this a fascinating thought process of, we're going to do something that Apple doesn't like, and Apple has actually publicly stated that we don't want them to do this, we consider this illegal. And what these folks are upset about isn't that someone leaked it early, it's that someone leaked it early and started selling it.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that's immoral.
Yeah.
They're selling it. That's not right. So we're going to...
So, the downside is that if it's not too late, you know, Apple's no doubt probably going to change the hardware involved and patch up that exploit that they've found. And so the next generation iPhone, they'll have to rework it and figure out something else.
Mm. Okay. So let's try line 4. Elizabeth, are you with us? Hello, Elizabeth from Aptos.
You got the right line.
Yeah, it's...
How come we don't have a busy tone or something?
No, it's just dead air. I don't know what's up. Mm. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. If you send us a message through the forums off our website, I'm sure either the geeks or one of our listeners could answer your question.
Yeah, definitely. Probably multiple times in different ways.
Does someone else have some... Actually, I have a news story.
Go for it, Miles.
Bring this up. Neuroscientists have found that we are they've already known that we were hardwired for some math, as opposed, there have been some research, like, for example, if you see three items, that there's a pattern recognition in our brain for three, not just we actually recognize three right off the bat. Well, it turns out there's a similar structure within the human brain for fractions.
Really?
That we don't see fractions naturally. Wow. As, you know, one number divided by another, which is what a fraction is. Like, one half is one divided into two pieces, one divided by two. That we actually see fractions as a separate unit. And
wow,
so when
that's
we take
really
time,
interesting.
So when we start to teach fractions in the way that we normally do, which is, you know, one piece divided by two, or three three items divided into four, three-fourths.
We're over-engineering it.
And it may be hurting our ability to teach people, to have people learn fractions. And so I'll be curious to see how this research goes to let people know. I mean, so to get it so that people can get the concept of fraction and learn them easier, and then go into the more logical or the more complete definition of them. But yeah, I knew it. We are hardwired for math.
Wait, you predicted this?
No, I was saying I knew it.
Oh, you knew it.
That we are hard, human beings, we are hardwired for math. When you say you're not good at math, it just means you weren't taught correctly.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that, I think. So,
of course, the geeks would say that, yeah.
Yeah, it's geek speak, for crying out loud. Do we have Elizabeth back?
Let's give it a shot. Elizabeth.
Me now?
Yeah, we have Elizabeth. Yay.
I was like, maybe I'm not supposed to ask this question.
Three tries.
You guys are great. Thank you so much for your show. I have a question. Are any of you familiar with or have you used StatCounter? I know that it's sort of the most highly recommended of all the tracking sites, and it has this really nice feature in that it can be invisible instead of you having this, you know, ugly thing on your site.
So you want to be able to track how many people are hitting your site, what time of day, get general
sort of
statistics?
Where they're coming from, like where they're mainly, you know, my main interest is sort of where are they finding out about me. So actually I have had it installed for several months, and my husband has also had it installed on his site and his another site that he works on. And the problem is that there's two places on StatCounter where you can exclude your own visits to your site. So every time I work on my site, instead of having 15 hits for the day, you know, while I'm uploading and changing things, it will count me out. And the two ways are you put in your ISP, which seems tricky if you have wireless because there's a whole range, and you also can put in a cookie so that, or I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly,
no,
but you can do something with the cookie so that it doesn't count your site. But the problem is that it doesn't work. I mean, it's like every day you have to put the cookie in again. And I've even looked at a forum about this that had a lot of comments. Most of the comments were a couple years old, so I was hoping maybe they fixed it. But
this goes into,
if anyone has experience, because it seems like it just doesn't work.
Yeah, this goes into a an area of web development that would take a little bit longer for me to explain how to set that cookie for longer term than we have right now on the show, unfortunately. But if you send us an email or post to the forums, we'll be able to get back with you on this.
Yeah, post on the forums and then everyone can see.
Yeah, there is a solution for this.
Okay, right. Yeah, sorry I didn't get to it earlier. All right, thanks, guys.
Take care.
Bye.
And Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Great Infusions, Coffee Beanery, and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisan coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potrero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly, hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronics parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks today have been Ben Jaffe and Ryder Brooks. Thank you both for coming here.
Thank you. Most certainly.
My name is Miles Elam. Thank you very much for listening to Geek Speak. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and you know, who wants to listen to that?
I do.
We do it all the time.
Yeah, that is true. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.